In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Only a man harrowing clods in a slow, silent walk, with an old horse that stumbles and nods, half asleep as they stalk. Only thin smoke without flame from the heaps of couch grass, yet this will go onward the same through dynasties pass. Yonder a maid in her white come whispering by, war's annals will cloud in the night ere their story die. Thomas Hardy. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I hope you had a good week and weekend since our last episode. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you enjoy the show and you'll peruse our backlog of episodes. And if you're a returning listener, thank you all so much. As always, your support means quite a lot. So, as you might have guessed from the title for this week's episode and from the poem by Thomas Hardy that I just read, we're going to be doing one of our specials that I've mentioned. This week we're going to be talking about horse domestication. Next week, I believe we will be doing our Indo-European episode, and then we'll go back to reviewing the Neolithic cultures of Southern Europe, of which there are quite a few to go over. But I did want to go ahead and let you guys know that on the day of September the 1st, so not next Monday, but the Monday following, there will be no episode. I am going out of town for that weekend, and it's going to take an extra day. I'll get back home essentially on Labor Day, but I won't be at home on Sunday night and have time to record. So apologies for that, but I hope you all have a good one when we get there. But for now, though, let's go ahead and focus on this week's topic, and that is horse domestication. Now, I'm just going to go ahead and cover some of the stuff that we've already mentioned so far this season, but the exact date of when horse domestication began, or I guess reached its culmination, is a matter of some debate. Some people say that it was early as 5000 BC, based on some discoveries in Central Asia. Other people think, you know, it began in the area that we've been discussing the last couple of weeks. This would be a little bit later, maybe about 4500, 4000 BC. And then others say it's even later. Same general area we've been discussing, but possibly as late as 2000 BC. Now, as we've gone over in other domestication episodes, you know, it's not always clear what is domesticated and what is not. Again, early domesticates resemble their wild cousins pretty closely, at least in the archaeological or bone record, as you would. So it's really hard to say for sure. Now, there are things that can kind of hint at when this happened in other ways. One of the big clues that people like to try and hone in on is evidence of wear on teeth. Sometimes you'll see evidence of horse teeth that have been biting, like a bridle or something in their mouth to keep them from nipping people. Because horses do bite. Wild horses especially bite. Feral horses, too. So, you know, they look at teeth a lot to kind of judge, is this a domesticated animal? At least for the early horses, because again, later horses, they become much more distinct once they are, you know, getting to the size that they can be ridden or carry larger loads. Today, there are two recognized subspecies of horse that are still extant. There is Equus ferus caballus. These are the horses you would see pretty much everywhere on Earth with very few exceptions. Even wild horses out in the American Southwest, the famous Mustangs, or, you know, in places like Australia, where they also have wild horse populations. These are all just feral horses, and they are descended from domesticated strains, and they've just been out in the wild, and they've returned, I guess, to nature, if you will. Then there is also the Equus ferus chevalski, and that is the sometimes known as the Mongolian wild horse, that is also referred to as the Taki, and there's also they're also in some places called Dzungarian horses. Now, it was thought for a long time that the chevalski's horse were just like, they were the same species that the domesticated strains came from, and they just had a wider range. However, with DNA testing, that's kind of gone out the window. They believe that these are just cousins of the horses that were domesticated by humans. So these are, they have a different number of chromosomes. I think they have 66, whereas the domesticated horse has 64. Just keep that in mind. Some places you'll still see the chevalski's horse referred to as, you know, the ancestors of modern horses. That is incorrect. So be careful when you read older sources, because that was pretty widely held until, you know, DNA testing kind of came to the fore. And Chevalski's name, by the way, is he was a Polish explorer. He went out to Mongolia and that region. Some people will say Chevalski, but I've also heard some people say Przewalski or Przewalski. So I'm not quite sure what the correct pronunciation is. I guess it's, you know, dependent on the language of the speaker, or at least the native language of the speaker. I'm not sure which is correct, but I've heard it most often pronounced Chevalski. And I'll include some pictures of them in the YouTube episode. If you guys are watching on YouTube, you'll be able to see it there. But typically, they're anywhere between 48 to 57 inches tall, which is about 122 to 142 centimeters, excuse me. And they weigh around 300 kilograms, which is about 650 pounds, I think. And most of them have like a kind of a dark, or I guess a lighter brown to kind of a maybe a light red. This is known as a dun coloring. They also have short kind of spiked manes, as opposed to domesticated horses, which have longer, I guess, flowing locks, I guess, for lack of a better term. You might think they, like, if you looked at them and you weren't familiar, you might think they were some kind of cross between a horse and a donkey or something like that. Very similar to zebra manes, actually, what they look like. And that's what the ancestors of the domesticated horse looked like. We know this because we have cave paintings that we've talked about in other places where they showed up. Now, there was another breed of horse. These are known as tarpan horses, also scientifically categorized as Equus ferus ferus. They were living on the Eurasian steppe up until about the 1900s. I think the last one died in like 1908, 1910, somewhere in that range. And that was actually in the Russian Empire. Tarpan is a Kyrgyz, like the country of Kyrgyzstan, and it just means wild horse. That's what tarpan means. That's where it comes from. Equus is, of course, the old Latin word for horse, which is came from, at least, you know, for the linguistics, it's thought to come from a Proto-Italic word, equos, which ultimately came from the Proto-Indo-European hechos, which also just meant horse. Ancient Greek, it'd be hippos, and Sanskrit, it's asva, and Persian, it's asb, or possibly asp. I couldn't quite get a good pronunciation guide for that in Persian, so apologies to my one Iranian listener. And of course, feral comes from, Ferus comes from the Latin ferus for wild. So the wild horses is equus equus ferus, which just means horse wild. And then for the equus ferus caballus, caballus comes from believed to be Celtic, which is caballos, and it means something like nag or you know, something like that. Though ancient Greek has something similar, it's caballus, which also means nag. And I'm not sure which one they took. I'm assuming they took from the Greek usage. But it could also just mean workhorse, just like an everyday working horse. But interestingly enough, caballos also is the root for caballero, which is like a Spanish gentleman. And then you also have French chevalier, an Italian cavalier. So in some ways, you know, it's like a gentleman's horse. Might be another way to read that. Now, some of this is based on observation of modern horse herds. So, you know, they're not necessarily a one-to-one of what our, you know, distant ancestors were dealing with, but it's probably fairly close. Wild horse herds, also known as harems, typically have one stallion and then several mares and then all the mares' offspring. And these can, you know, vary in size. Some just have, you know, four or five individuals, like of adult age, maybe one or two foals at a given time. And then some cases you have a harem that's over a dozen members. And their territories overlap. So they kind of share kind of the same general range with several harems together. So depending on the resources, you could have anywhere from, you know, maybe 120, 200 horses. And then if there's enough resources together, you might have nearly 2,000 horses in some places. I know that that's one of the wild Mustang herds in America. They think that they're in like, I think it's in Nevada. I think it's like the Virginia range. They say that they may have up to 2,000 wild horses living, you know, in the same general area. So there's no reason to think that would necessarily be any different. Now, males are dominant. The females are much more docile, especially compared to the males. However, in the herds, the females do establish pecking order, essentially. And female horses will, you know, kind of keep themselves in line. Ultimately, like if, say if there's like a primary mare, if you will, she comes first and then, you know, other horses kind of come behind her. Now you do see occasions where there aren't really harems, but there might be one stallion who has managed to, kind of draw away, one mare, and then they might establish their own herd, but that's generally rare. Horses tend to mate in the spring, and it takes almost a year for them to give birth. And, you know, horses will walk up to an hour after being born, so they're kind of on the move pretty quickly. Now, in the wild, during this period, horses have to worry about wolves, and, you know, that's their main predator that they're having to deal with, wolves. Possibly wild dogs, and of course humans. Now, in the even more remote past, there were much more predators. They'd have to worry about things like cave hyenas, wild, you know, European lions, things like that. But these days, it's just wolves, at least where we're talking about in our podcast timeline. I don't think bears really try to get horses. They're much too fast for bears to get to. While horses, you know, aren't that large, they do kind of, at least at the direction of the male, they will kick and bite, and their kicks can easily kill a horse if they or a wolf and they hit them in the right spot. Kill a human too, for that matter, if they hit them right. So horses, while, you know, small and Bitey, you'd be much more worried about being kicked than bit by a horse, although apparently the bites are very painful. Another factor, in horses, sometimes the stallions will kill baby horses. I think one of the things I saw on the Chvalsky horses is that, one in four foals will die every year, and about 83-85%, somewhere in that range, of those deaths are by the leading stallion killing one of the foals. Now, I don't know why that is. I'm assuming that they kind of have their own population management, or perhaps from the period where the foal was conceived, the stallion may have replaced the previous stallion. And that does happen. Once a male horse reaches sexual maturity, around 2 years of age, they are kicked out of the herd. And then the young colts will form bachelor bands with other kind of displaced horses. And they'll kind of develop their own pecking order. They'll help defend each other, but they do kind of defer to the strongest and the largest of these bachelors. And then they will occasionally go around as a group looking for females. And, occasionally they'll find some lost mare from another harem. And they, the lead horse might establish his own harem with her, and then the other guys will go off. And then there's also the case where these groups of stallions will come up, and the leader of the stallion band will challenge the leader of a harem. And in some cases, he wins, and he kind of takes over the former stallion's harem. The old stallion is kind of left on his own, and usually when that happens, they're kind of towards the end of their lifespan, and they'll be hunted down by, wolves or humans or whatever. And then the former bachelor band will leave without their, former leader, and they'll establish a new pecking order, as it were, and they'll have a new leader. While at the same time, they'll absorb other young colts from other herds that have been kicked out. And so, as you might have guessed, not all male horses in the wild are able to obtain a harem and pass on their lineage, and that is something that we have seen from DNA evidence. Mitochondrial DNA for horses is much more varied than, say, the male lineage of horses. There's far fewer male horses in a horse's genealogy than there are female horses. And that may have been one of the keys to humans being able to domesticate them. As I said, female horses, while they do have like an internal pecking order and they will fight kind of amongst themselves, once they've established their hierarchy in their group, they tend to be fairly docile, generally only attacking if their foals or themselves are, in explicit danger. Otherwise, female horses are very docile creatures, and they will and can be led astray, by, again, wild stallions, bachelor groups. That does happen, and it can happen very easily. In fact, one of the reasons that the tarpan horse was hunted to extinction, even after, horse domestication was, well and truly established, is because these wild stallions would come in and they just leave away domestic mares. They just go off with them to, be out in the wild. So that is one of the things that led to them being, hunted to extinction. They would also, of course, get into fields and things like that and tear down or eat up crops and stuff like that. So, if as long as humans had something that they could, gently coerce or, use to attract a female horse, it would be very easy to lead them away from their harems. And perhaps if a young female horse got kicked out of her group because she was reaching sexual maturity, you know, the other female horses kicked her out or ostracized her, or the, you know, the stallion didn't do anything. You know, humans could have captured female horses fairly easily, and that could have been used to attract male horses, these wild young stallion bands. And, you know, if you think about it that way, you know, if these humans have all these female horses that they're keeping, or at least just one or two, that might draw in some wild stallions. And then those stallions could be caught. Some of them could be butchered, and then you would probably keep the strongest and largest one to, you know, breed the females that you have. And it works out for the wild stallion bands because, you know, they have a much higher chance of mating with domesticated or captured female horses than they do wild horses. And in fact, I just said that, but come to think of it, it would probably be easier to keep the male horses that were weakest and less wild. So, you know, they probably got rid of the bigger and stronger ones and kept some of the more timid male horses. And I say timid as a relative term, not as in a general term, because again, male horses can be huge dicks if they want to be. Also, with domesticated stallions, or at least semi-domesticated stallions, you know, you wouldn't have to fight off other male horses either. You know, you might lose a mare or two when they start another herd. Maybe they get another horse in. But by and large, you aren't facing challengers nearly as often as probably a stallion out in the wild, which they're probably doing that at least once a year, if not more. Especially during mating season. These early horses, they are not large enough for humans to ride. I'll show a picture, but they're not much bigger than donkeys. And they're kind of squat and stout, so they can carry more than you might think. But for a full-grown man, probably not that comfortable for the horse, and probably not that comfortable for the rider either. And it is a question of when horses were first bred to be ridden. But, at least in the early days, they didn't have anything to control the horse. Once you're on it, the horse is going to go, and you may or may not be able to stop them. So make of that what you will. However, they would eventually come up with leads, things like that. Eventually, they would come up with some type of bridle to help control horses' movements. Probably the first, you know, the first use of ridden horses, they would not be ridden far, and they may have just been used to travel, you know, distances, and then they would get off them. Riding horses into battle is something that comes about much later for numerous reasons that we'll talk about. But these are good pack animals. You could easily tie loads onto their backs, things like that. And then you'd also be able to eventually have them pull sleds or sledges, which, you know, these are just wooden planks or just bundles kind of roped together. Eventually, and this is in the future, eventually, of course, they'll learn that you can create a wheel, slap a wheel on these sledges, and it becomes a cart, and then eventually that will lead to the chariot, but that's well into the future, and we'll talk about that much more later. Now, initially, horses were kept primarily for meat, probably. They were just another protein source, same as cows and, you know, wild deer and things like that. However, fairly quickly after they are kept as a domesticated meat source, they are also begun to be milked for, milk, but also, you know, milk byproducts, cheese, things like that. You can ferment mare's milk. It's known as kumis, I think, is what the technical term for that is. And kumis is a little bit stronger than fermented cow's milk, which is kefir, which that's cows or goats or something like that. And mare's milk has higher sugar, so kumis typically is a lot stronger of a beverage than alcoholic milk from cows or goats. So that's probably another reason why they are kept in such numbers. You can also use mare's milk for cosmetics. I think it has actually been shown to help with eczema. Now, if they're using it at this early stage, I don't know, but I think it is possible. But I know in France, there's like a brand of products made from mare's milk today. Initially they're kept just for meat. Then you have, we talked about this a while ago, but it's like the secondary products revolution. Horses, they don't have a huge amount of secondary products you can use them for, but they are incredibly useful animals in ways that cows and sheep and goats are not. Leather, things like that. But of course, eventually they become rideable, which is just, that is a major factor, in human adoption and use. And we'll talk about that much more later, of course, as well. Now, I was looking up numbers on this, but and I couldn't quite get a firm confirmation one way or another. But of course, horses, you have a huge number of breeds. I think the only animal that we have more breeds for than horses are dogs. Thoroughbreds, and you have racing horses, you have chargers, destriers. I butchered that pronunciation, excuse me. The Clydesdales, just a wide variety of horse breeds for a number of different things. And of course you have ponies, which are, small horses. They are Equus ferus caballus, but they are just very small. And there are a lot of different terminologies that we have for horses in a lot of languages, and they all kind of refer to specific types of horses or horses at different stages of their development. Some far more than you have with dogs. Like a dog, you have a dog and you have a puppy. A cat, you have a kitten. But for horses, you have foals, which is it's a horse less than a year old. You have a yearling, which is a horse that's between a year and 2 years old. You have colts, which is a male horse that's under four. You have a filly, which is the female version of the colt. You have a mare that's 4 years or older. And you have a stallion, which is a male that's 4 years and older that is not castrated. And then you have gelding, which is a castrated horse of any age. And there are plenty of other terms used as well. And we'll talk about, the importance of the horse for, a number of different people and why all these different terms exist in future episodes. And of course, that's not even to talk about, you have horses with different coloring. You have black, pure black horses. You have horses with the kind of the white markings. You have horses that are red. You have horses that are white. All these different types of things are eventually selectively bred. And these are for reasons, just for aesthetic purposes. These don't necessarily serve any kind of practical purpose. So that is something, that you don't really see except in dogs. So, or cats, now that I think about it. In fact, I'm sure cat breeds, there's probably more cat breeds than horse breeds. But the relationship for the horse is very different from that of, say, cow and sheep and goats. And that's not to say that people don't like those animals, that those animals aren't important, but, by and large, horses are very much a prestige animal in a way that, cows and sheep and goats are not. And we'll, of course, see that in, historical examples much later. So it's a very deep relationship between humans and horses. Now, today, it's not quite that deep because most humans don't own horses anymore. Not that, you know, the vast majority of people owned horses in the past, but more people owned them in the past than they do today. Of course, today, a human might have the relationship with his car that a man in the past might have had with his horse. So and that is one of those things, you know, I'd like to kind of compare and contrast. And another thing we talked about, and I mentioned it before, but I'll say it again. One of the bonuses of horses, at least in more northerly climes or in places where you see a lot of snow, horses are smart enough to dig up and kick around snow and eat the grass underneath snow and ice. Cows, sheep, goats, at least at this early stage, they're not that smart, apparently. They don't know, like, hey, you have to dig under the grass or under the snow to find grass to eat. So you don't have to grow as much fodder to feed horses in the winter as, say, cows or sheep or goats or things like that. Horses also are much cleverer than those animals, at least from, you know, everything I've read. Horses can be trained, of course, to trot or do maneuvers, you know, kind of march sideways. They can also be trained to kind of go to the ground. Horses sleep both standing up or on the ground in some cases. Though, of course, with this intelligence also does come other issues. Horses have a lot of personality as individuals. They can and do occasionally have stubborn streaks. Of course, there's the famous English saying that you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. They're, you know, as an animal, they are, you know, again, closer to dogs and cats in terms of the intelligence they have in their relations with humans. And again, that's not to say that, you know, people didn't care for their other animals, in terms of, like, a relationship between an individual and their horse, it's going to be much deeper than, say, an individual and their cow or their goat or their sheep. And I mean that in terms of an emotional connection to the animal. Obviously, you know, if you rely on your cow for milk and cheese or your goat, obviously they're important for your survival. And, you know, you would care for them to that extent, but I feel like, you know, if you have multiple animals, you'll probably love your horse more than you would love necessarily your cow. Now, if you didn't have, you know, a cow to milk or slaughter, you know, you'd probably be wanting food. And in that case, you would very much miss your cow, but your cow's not going to be as good of a companion as, say, a horse. So again, obviously there's give and take, but, you know, as humans become more wealthy and diversify how they're obtaining food, or food ceases to be a little bit less of an issue, you know, horses will become more valuable than, say, cows or sheep or goats. And that, I think, plays out in the historical record quite well. There is literature from a number of places on how to, what traits to look for in a horse, what you should do when buying a horse, how you should train your horse. These are all things, you know, that you really don't see in other livestock. And a horse is, again, just kind of put this all together and make it simple and shorten it. A horse is a livestock animal, but it's also kind of a pet in some ways that cows and sheep and goats are not, or chickens too. Though, again, obviously individuals can love those animals too. But generally speaking, it's not quite to the same level historically as you see with horses or dogs and cats too, for that matter. So that's kind of the highlights for the horse domestication. Again, the dates on this are super debated, but I did kind of see some stuff that makes me think, yeah, it probably is starting to happen this season. Whereas I was thinking it would be next season initially. That's why I didn't do a horse episode at the start of this season when I did the domestication episode on the other animals. So we'll probably do like an update to horse stuff because there's a lot of things I want to talk about when it comes to coat collars, when those are thought to have emerged, markings, things like that. That's for future Preston to figure out and for you guys to hopefully listen to. So I'm going to go ahead and call it here for this evening. Next week we'll be back. We'll be talking about Proto-Indo-European, its origins, its, the theories about it, the controversies about it, all that kind of stuff, because that is also a language that is probably coming about during this season in this area. Again, probably, at least at the very early stages. Obviously, we don't know for sure, but the spread of Indo-European and the spread of horses are tied in together. So I wanted to talk about horses first to kind of give you guys an idea. And you may have already gotten a little of that when I was talking about all the various names for the different type of horses, how in-depth the language is when talking about these animals. And again, it's not to say that these other animals, like these other livestock animals, don't have their own terminology that, you know, the average person doesn't know. But your average person does know more about horses than they do any other animal. And I think that's, you know, another thing to kind of keep in mind and think about, too. So, I appreciate you all for coming out this week. I appreciate your support, as always. If you guys have any questions, comments, or concerns, or constructive criticism, please reach out to me at war@revpod@gmail.com. You can also contact me via direct message on X/Twitter, and you can comment on the YouTube videos. I see comments there, and I try to respond as quickly as I can. Quick updates on the ads. So I am going to keep those running. However, I am going to turn off the mid-roll ads. I think those are especially obnoxious. It's not a huge amount of money one way or the other without those or with those. So I'm just going to drop it. So you don't have to worry about that. And of course, with YouTube people, you don't have to worry about ads either. But I hope you all have enjoyed. And I hope to hear from you. If you have any, questions, comments, constructive criticism, I'd be happy to hear from you. And I hope you have a good rest of your day and week from whenever you listen to this episode. I'll see you all next time. Peace.